listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day and welcome along to episode 100 of the Howie Games. The tunny's up. Woohoo! Not something I anticipated when the show started, but like the great Jason Gillespie, yeah, we'll take it.
That's a lovely shot through the covers. And 100 for Jason Gillespie. Look at that. Coming in as a night watchman and getting a test century.
Dizzy famously went on to make 201 not out in that innings against Bangladesh. I'm not sure the podcast has got another century in it. Who knows? I don't want to bang on at the start of the show, but please indulge me just for a minute or two. I'll leave the thank yous to the end of the podcast, except for two. A huge thank you off the top to all of you good people who have listened to the show along the way. Without your support of the podcast, there is no Howie Games. None. You have provided so much encouragement and positive feedback along the way. You've shared the show with your family and friends. You have sent me countless wonderful messages about where you're listening, the impact certain episodes have had on you, and for some, it's become a part of your weekly ritual, which is really, really cool. Thanks. The second thank you is to all the guests who have given up their valuable time and trusted me to share their stories and, in some cases, their innermost thoughts and fears. I have lent on a lot of friendships along the way, especially in the early series of the show, to get people involved as guests. But for me, from the start, it's always been an enormous privilege to sit across from so many amazing people and just have a good old chat about sport and life. And when the show first started, I pretty much had three aims I was trying to meet. One, to take you all into the lives of athletes and show who they really are as people. Two, for it to be a positive and uplifting show. There's enough negativity in the world. And three, for it to be able to motivate the audience. Hopefully, fingers crossed, the podcast has met these aims.
So you search and try to find, but you don't know where to go. So many thoughts flood through your mind. You're confused and want to know. Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
The first episode, which I actually went back and checked the date, the 25th of August 2016, the first one released was with the great Gilly, Adam Gilchrist, and Michael James, the first producer of the show. MJ and I went into full celebration mode when after 2 weeks we had reached 100 downloads. We were absolutely pumped. Sort of crazy now to think that the download numbers are somewhere near 40 million. Blows my mind. And although Gilly was the first episode released, broadcast legend Dennis Cometti was the first episode I actually recorded. I don't reckon Den or I was that convinced of the name of the show right back then.
Well, it's a great pleasure to come to a very nice hotel in Melbourne to sit opposite you, Den. How are you?
I'm good, Howie.
Welcome,
very good.
Welcome to the Howie Games. I was struggling to come up with a name.
Howie Games.
The Howie Games. Well, I was sitting on the surfboard yesterday thinking, wow, I've got to present a name here, and you being first cab off the rank. So it's the Howie Games.
I like it.
With Mark Howard.
Okay.
Sort of half Hunger Games, half the Olympic Games.
Half War Games.
Half War Games.
Yes.
Yeah, the name stuck, I guess.
So many lost and left behind, and no one seemed to care. Those who should seems like they're blind, pretending they're not there. Can't they see they hold the key? Could make things better if they try. Oh my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes?
Okay, enough of looking backwards. As you know from the title now, episode 100 of the Howie Games features champion Australian golfer Adam Scott.
Is 2 for 2 in Florida.
For me, Adam is the perfect guest, to bring up the ton with, because in my time watching sport, three iconic moments stand out. Cathy Freeman, episode 25 of the show, winning gold in Sydney. John Aloisi, episode 86 of the show, taking us to the World Cup with that penalty, and Adam becoming the first Aussie to win the Masters. This episode took nearly 3 years to come to fruition and comes to you courtesy of Uniqlo, a wonderful clothing brand for whom Adam is a global ambassador. Thanks to Adam, Simon Miller from Uniqlo, and Adam's agent, Johan Elliott from Sport Yard International, for making the episode possible.
Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie? Come on, children, trot with me. We want to reach Mount Zion.
Scotty, as he's universally known, Scotty has a brilliant story to tell, a story that will forever be etched in Australian sporting history. It was so good to hear him tell it in such a relaxed, entertaining, reflective, and at times funny manner. He's a pretty private person, Scotty, and I hadn't heard a lot of these stories. From his early years, mind games, which are quite incredible, when he was taking on Tiger Woods early on, dealing with pressure, the pain of the 2012 British Open, and plenty more. But the episode culminates with one of the most enjoyable conversations I've ever had on the podcast, when Adam takes us through the closing stages of his history-making Masters win in 2013. He almost goes through it shot by shot. I tell you what, here's an upfront guarantee for you. It will give you goosebumps. Enjoy the captivating story of Adam Derek Scott.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion.
Welcome to the show, one of Australia's most accomplished golfers of all time. It's been a while trying to get him on, and I'm absolutely pumped he's here, Adam Scott. Scotty, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, mate. Thanks. How are you?
I'm excellent.
Good.
Strange times, strange times. How are you going?
Yeah. Look, all things considered, everything's good, and spending more time in Australia than I normally do, which is great for me and my family. We're spending a lot of time together. And probably at this point in my life, it's a nice forced break for me, let's say.
You've only got young kids. They're not old enough for homeschooling, are they, or are they?
Our daughter has been doing some homeschooling, which is brutal. Look, I don't know. I have to say I've pretty much given up on that. She's only five. She'll be okay.
It's an emotional roller coaster, isn't it? I have two kids doing it at the moment. It says good days and there's bad days.
Yeah, absolutely. Very difficult for everybody involved. I mean, the kids and the parents. I mean, if we were teachers, we'd be teachers, wouldn't we? So it's challenging, but, we are lucky up here. We've been up in Queensland for a while and we've been able to go to the beach the whole time and run the kids around and wear them out down there, and that's been fortunate for us.
There's so much to talk about with you, and I'm really looking forward to it. But before we get too far into it, you're here on behalf of Uniqlo, where you're a global ambassador, so I appreciate that. And you've been doing some work with the Royal Flying Doctor Service. It's interesting during this time, Scotty, what people can do to help. And you've been alongside Uniqlo trying to do a few things yourself, which has been really appreciated in your local community.
Well, after kind of getting some understanding of what could possibly happen returning to Australia and seeing, the severity of where the virus went in Europe and China as well, and then America, just wondered if there's anything possible that I can do to help on any kind of scale. You know, this thing is the biggest kind of scale I've ever seen in my lifetime, that's for sure. So, Uniqlo is a fantastic partner for me, and they have incredible resource, especially in this garment manufacturing. And just reached out to them to see if there was any way they could help with like personal protective equipment, just in case. I was reading a lot of stories about nurses in particular who were kind of not getting enough of this personal protective equipment, having to kind of change their clothes at work and have to leave with clothes, and just wasn't tight enough given how severe and how easily this virus was spreading. So anyway, they were really only too happy to help. They were able to source these masks and this personal protective equipment and get some down to Australia. So we then had to figure out, it's so hard to know, to single out one area to put this stuff. But when they came up with the Royal Flying Doctors Service, it really resonated with me. It's kind of iconic Australian institution. and maybe not the first one you'd think about when you're looking at COVID-19, but for them to continue to provide the services they need, they go out to the bush, they come back into the areas that are affected, the hospitals that are treating, all that, they need to be prepared as well. So I felt like to donate to them was really sat well with me, and was really grateful of Uniqlo to provide their resource to do that.
There's a lot of masks produced as well, wasn't there, that you were able to hand off?
We sent 150,000 masks down to the Royal Flying Doctors, and Uniqlo globally has donated 10 million masks so far.
Wow, that's an extraordinary effort. I'm fascinated, Scotty. I'm going to call you Scotty because it's too formal to call you Adam.
That's what everyone calls me.
Well, I'm fascinated to know how this hour and a bit's going to go, because for such a high-profile athlete, we don't generally know a great deal about you. We don't hear a great deal from you. You're a quiet chap. You're a quiet chap, it'd be fair to say.
Mate, I guess so. I kind of have always tended to let my clubs do the talking. I don't know where I heard that early in my career, but it kind of sat well with me and keeps me out of trouble that way most of the time. But, you know, that's the way I like to be. And especially in this social media age, I think I just must have missed that that school, because I have no idea about the technology and social media stuff, and I know it can be very valuable and it can be a great way to interact, but you know, hopefully I'm also trying to balance my life with a family and stuff that I already feel like I give so much of my time away from them that I'm trying to keep things together at home as well. That's me personally, how I feel. And I'm also not the best time manager, so I have to kind of limit the things that I have ambitions to do.
Well, I must say your time management was good this morning, because you were in this meeting before I was, but your technology, I'm not sure
had to talk me through the whole thing, basically.
What you did do, before we start your journey though, which I really enjoyed, and it was a fascinating insight into your workplace, when you had your mate Mr. Persky the other day, and you went out and did an Instagram 9 holes, and I thought to myself, wow, there could be a commentator in Adam Scott. It was really good, mate.
All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to 9 holes with a mate, the Mullaney Golf Club. I'm not going to spend too much energy or time wondering why I'm hitting hooks. I'm just going to probably start aiming right a bit and have to fix this after the round. If I was on tour, I'd go to the range after the round if I wasn't happy that I was turning the ball over.
It's your day-to-day job, things you don't actually think about much, but to explain it, and I was watching and I was fascinated by it. I'm sure it was really well received, and you were just you're just having fun out on the golf course, but it was brilliant, mate.
I really think that expectation is a big thing. You know, if you only get to play on a weekend, you get to do no practice during the week, and you have a very limited warm-up. You might be coming straight from the office or straight from the house to the first tee. Give yourself a break and give yourself a few holes to warm up before you start getting down on yourself, because it's not the easiest game. There's lots of variables. Yeah, thanks. Well, it's really the first kind of personal thing I've done with social media. I actually really liked the fact it was live.
Yeah.
I felt like this is good, this is raw, it's kind of a bit more real. Further in the left side of the green than I've ever seen it. And there's wind right to left up the field. That'll be all right. It's on. Okay, got the nod. Here we go. The comeback begins. And it was at a time when there wasn't really any golf being watched. Not that the golf was anything to rave about. Wayne played all right, but
he did.
I struggled around, managed to halve him. But it was, you know, my agenda was, you know, a lot of these guys in the golf world, there are a lot of people struggling off the back of what's happened. And, you know, to promote a little golf on the Sunshine Coast with my buddies is something fun. So hopefully, when people can get moving around a bit again and they're thinking about going for a hit, they might think of popping up to Mullaney or one of the other courses up here that are really great, especially fun story of what's happening up there with a community project. But look, I enjoyed it. I think I'll try and do another one before I head back off, because it was well received and it was fun. And it's quite nice sometimes for me to actually talk about my golf rather than it being reported. And then it's from the horse's mouth, if you want. And the message that I want to get out there gets out there.
Well, the message was that it was fun. That's the bit I got,
yeah.
That it was fun. But do you see now, you sort of might slide into Jim Nance-style territory and eventually be on CBS in the golf commentary box?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I hope I've got plenty of playing days left in me, Howie, rather than the announcing. So we've halved the match. Sorry for a no result for all you out there. But I'm pretty happy that I now don't have to live with Wayne beating me on 9 holes with a mate. But it's been so much fun. Thanks, Kirst. Thanks, Mulaney, again. Thanks, Jimmy. I hope you guys have enjoyed this. But I saw Justin Thomas doing the announcing on the course there for the match with Tiger and Phil. I think a lot of the players probably have some really good insight. One of my good buddies, Trevor Immelman, is kind of stepping up in the announcing world now, and he's incredibly knowledgeable. And I know he works really hard at it. It's not just like you roll into it too. So I think although 9 holes with Adam on his Instagram live is fun, I think it's really hard work doing it as a profession.
I watched a bit of the match, and if Tom Brady doesn't do enough winning Super Bowls and having a beautiful family, then he goes and holes out from distance. What a freak of a man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, go in! Yeah. Oh, my goodness!
Oh, you made it!
Wow!
Take a second out.
I know. He's like in this category of people, you know, there's like Kelly Slater, Tom Brady. These guys, everything they do good. They're just these gifted athletes. And, you know, Kelly Slater, he surfs, he plays golf amazing, he plays guitar on stage with Pearl Jam and stuff, you know, he's ridiculous. And Brady's the same kind of guy. But it's really just what's up in their head, you know, more than anything. They just have this belief and this calmness in their head about what they do that makes them rise to all these occasions.
So if you're a brilliant golfer, if you're an elite golfer, what's your second best skill in life?
It's fine. Nothing.
Well, it's just golf, and that's
quite close. Nothing quite close to that. I think I'm okay at lots of other things. You know, I love sports. I love to think I'm capable of holding my own in all kinds of sports. But it's the sad truth is, as you get older, you just don't really see how much worse you are at it. You know, I like playing tennis. And I like surfing a bit, and I'm not particularly great at either. You know, when I go surf, and I've surfed a few times with Kelly, you know, his golf is so much better than my surfing. They're not even on the same level. So,
do you pinch yourself when you're out there surfing with an 11-time world champion, or is it just okay? That's another day in the life of Adam Scott.
I mean, I want to watch him as much as surf myself, you know, just to be out there. But I've had some incredible experiences with him in the water at Pipeline in Hawaii. And, you know, not my other good mate is Julian Wilson from up here at Coolum. And just last Thursday or Friday, he called me. He's like, hey, Scotty, the waves are really good out the front of your house. I'm going in the water. Just as I'm making the kids lunch, I'm like, oh, no, how am I going to get out of this one? But I managed to get the kids to scoff their lunch down, and I ran out there. And we went out there, and there was tons of people in the water, but Julian took off on this lovely wave, went right, and, you know, we couldn't see because we were behind. And then all of a sudden you see this guy like 10 feet in the air with a full rotation. And he goes down, and we don't know if he lands, and a second later he pops out, kicks out, and everyone just like erupts. It was so fun, you know, for me the other day to see that, to see one of my buddies, and not in competition, but like how happy and everyone is for him up here in the water and around town. It's really cool to see.
And then did you take the next wave and do a reverse air yourself?
Yeah, reverse air straight into the sand.
Right, I digressed. We've got to get to golf. Yeah. We've got to get, I'm sure, like most athletes, though, you'd rather talk about things like surfing than golf. But, mate, where did golf start for you? What's your first memory of playing golf as a young bloke?
Yeah, I was born in Adelaide and we lived there until I was about 7 years old. And my dad's a professional golfer. He's a member of the Aussie PGA and my mum's a good player too. And dad took me out to North Adelaide par three course when I'm guessing around five. That's when I remember being out. Maybe I was four, maybe I was five. But I remember that very vividly. Playing North Adelaide par three a lot. And that was fun because I could hit my one wood onto the green and actually play like a par. So that was a good way to start. I really strongly think that. And I tell a lot of parents who want their little kids to get into golf, you know, you've got to get them started where the hole's not so big, you know, where it doesn't seem ridiculous and put them off playing where it never ends. You know, get them up there to 40 yards or 60 yards from the green and get them to hit it on the green. So that was where I started. And I played a little bit. It wasn't like I was obsessed with golf at that point. I played Aussie rules down there as well, and I was probably more obsessed with that at the time.
So you were Adelaide Crows man?
Crows, yeah.
So when you were growing up watching the footy, who was your man?
Well... it was even before the Crows existed at that point in Adelaide. Oh. Yeah, I supported Norwood.
Okay.
And Gary McIntosh was my man at Norwood. He was playing with Michael Ashe and Gary McIntosh.
You're going old school on now.
No, but I remember Gary McIntosh. We went and watched Sturt play Norwood and Gary McIntosh just flicked the Sturt player over the fence into the crowd, and I just thought, that guy is the man, he didn't care. It was good stuff. But, yeah, so that was a long, long time ago. And then, obviously, you know, the kind of the glory days of the Crows were with Tony Modra and crew there. So, you know, there was late 90s was good times.
What type of footballer were you? If you had to compare yourself to a modern AFL player, what was a young Adam Scott? Were you skillful? Were you getting in and under? Were you tough? Were you hard? Or were you a pretty boy out on the flank? What were you doing?
I don't know how tough we were when I was six or seven. I was a pretty wiry, small kid. Yes. So, but I could kick a footy, and I had my mate Nick Becker down in full forward, and I just used to ping it down to him, and he'd kick the goals, and occasionally I'd kick a couple as well.
When did golf, you said you weren't that obsessed with it at the start, mate, when did it become a major part of your life?
Yeah, so we moved up to Queensland, and then a couple of years after moving up, in about 1990, my dad got the job as the golf manager at Twin Waters Resort when it opened. And then I kind of, from that point, I had a lot of access to golf. You know, I was able to be out there all the time, and I was a junior member at Twin Waters, and I got a handicap, and I'd start going out with Dad. You know, he'd open up at 5:30 in the morning on a weekend, and I'd be out there just all day. I might play the comp and then practice and then play another nine and, yeah, just spend my weekends. And there was a good crew of juniors at Twin Waters at that point, and we all got along well, very competitive. And the handicap just started coming down, and that's you know, when you see things like that, little results happen, you get hooked.
If you weren't going to become a professional golfer, what was the plan B for Adam Scott? Were you a studious type? What were you thinking life was going to entail?
Yeah, I clearly remember in grade six, and that's about when I got hooked, really hooked on golf. Yep. Was, you know, the meetings with the teachers started happening, that I don't apply myself, that there's, you know, you've got to have a backup plan. Golf doesn't work out. You know, hardly anyone becomes like Greg Norman, all those kind of conversations. So I started wavering after grade five at school. It was a rocky path for me to get through. But, you know, I was just there in my head. My head was somewhere else. And I think probably more than anyone could see now, I was so determined at that point to make it in golf. I was just going to do whatever it took, and I just kind of checked the boxes along the way.
Where do you sit on the, now that you're a parent, where are you going to sit on the plan B option? Because some athletes say on this show, you need a plan B. Others are like, don't have a plan B because it's an excuse for plan A to fail.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think I was really lucky. I had both parents were golfers, but my dad, that's been his life. He's been in golf his entire life with the PGA of Australia, and he taught me until I was 19 years old, and he had some idea of where my talent level was at, and also then probably my application personally, not being pushed, but, you know, he could see me advancing and he could see my level being, I guess, exceptional for my age. So they didn't stress me too much about plan B. Mm. It's funny though, because I never ever, I mean, I was ready to leave high school. I was, you know, but I ended up, things fell in place where I ended up finishing high school, and that was good. I mean, you're too young to get out on the tour when you're 17, I believe, still. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not mature enough. But then I never thought I would go to university, but I ended up going to university in America because I thought it just fell that way. It was not a dream. I just wanted to get out and play golf. And then the next minute I'm over there sitting in a classroom doing more studies. But it was kind of to play golf, to get out of Australia, to open the door to America, because the US is where I wanted to be. So it's funny how it all worked out like that. Now, I didn't finish college, but I got to experience it. So, you know, I think, and now it seems like if you follow golf closely, almost all the good young players on the PGA Tour coming out in their early 20s have been at college. It is now the breeding ground for taking your game to that next level.
I had a look about a bit of your education. I don't write much down, Scotty, but you went to uni in Las Vegas.
I did. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. They had the best golf program.
No, I don't believe
that's why
that.
I went there.
I don't believe that at all.
Amazingly, they did. At the time, they were the number one team in the country. They just won the NCAA championship. And there were a few colleges kind of doing their recruiting, and they sent their prospectuses down to me in Australia, and UNLV had like this glossy magazine style thing and it looked amazing, and the others sent like photocopy pages stapled together, and I was like, no, well, let's go with this Las Vegas. That's Las Vegas, let's go. Yeah, so I got two educations while I was there.
And what was that like for a young bloke out of Adelaide and then the Gold Coast to all of a sudden be lining up as an athlete in a college system in Vegas? Were you a regular on the strip, or were you a bit more studious and doing what you're meant to be doing?
I just turned 18 when I got there. And, of course, in America anyway, the legal age is 21, so it was a little tricky for me, and I looked about 14 too. That was the other problem. But, you know, looking back on it, it was tough at the time. I was really a bit of a fish out of water there. I'd had it pretty good here, and I was a big fish in a little pond, and I went over there, and, Matt Kuchar was the big star in college at the time. Actually, another Aussie, James McLean, was the national college champion. Just adapting to, you know, living on my own. I was actually in the dorms with roommates and suite mates and stuff. And, yeah, I struggled for a little while over there. Then years later, you look back on it and it was like kind of the toughening up of Adam in a sense. Although it was hard, I didn't play particularly well, especially the first 6 months at college. I had to toughen up and overcome something. And that's held me in good stead as I went out on tour. It was a bit of the life lessons I needed to get out. And that's where I felt like, you know, I said before, you're not mature enough coming out of just high school. There's a really interesting period, I think, certainly for male golfers, where you're 17, 18, and then you're still doing a fair bit of growing too, I think, a lot of people, until they're 20, 21. And to feel that period where your game can advance and you mature as a person and how you're, you know, financially supporting that is a tough thing to balance, and because you're really not ready for the tour unless you're... I mean, Tiger Woods was even 21, I think, when he got on tour.
We'll get to the tour in a moment. When did you first beat your dad? Was it a seminal moment? Can you remember it or not?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I do.
I thought you might.
Feel bad for just ripping on dad now. I was 12.
12?
Yeah, I was at Twin Waters. And I, at the time, you know, he was still fair. He was young and moving, swinging at it all right. And I got him for 9. I think I might have shot about square for 9 holes at Twin, and that was good enough. He had an off day.
And is that something that you remember bringing up with him, or is just, I beat Dad, I just better move on with this?
Yeah, I have a feeling like I could tell he was kind of proud, but then, you know, actually not. The competitiveness was like, this happened way too early. I think I tempered my celebrations and only told like half the members of the club.
One other thing I want to talk to you about before we turn pro. You would have been at that formative age watching the great man who we've been very lucky to have on this show, Greg Norman. How was it watching Greg at Augusta for you? Were these like they were for me, heart-wrenching moments that almost left you with a mental scar?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was.
Ben, the one thing you guard against here is short. I got to believe if Norman wants to go the back nine with a three-shot lead, he has to be long.
He must be long, Ken. You're right.
He has only 100 yards to the hole.
Oh, there it is, Kenny.
That's what you have to guard against. That is... You just can't do that. You have to be long. Now you've got a big problem.
Just the other week when we were sitting back here, it was meant to be Masters week, and we saw all the reruns of all the, you know, and when you see 96, particularly for me, I was a bit older when that one happened. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. You just can't believe it still happened. And even though I feel like I've had bad finishes in tournaments and majors as well, and you still can't believe it can happen. No. But I can relate. It can really, the intensity certainly of the Masters and the other majors, it's just so hard to explain, you know, when it goes wrong, how quickly it can all really go wrong. I mean, even just a few years ago, Rory had that big lead at the Masters, and then he had that trouble on 10, and it all kind of fell away from him. It can just go so wrong so quickly. It's hard to watch. But I modelled everything I did off Greg. I mean, he was an incredible role model as a kid growing up watching him. I mean, obviously, he was a huge charismatic figure.
Yeah,
he played aggressive attack style golf, which was so appealing to many people. He swung at it hard, you know, hit the big shots. He went down in flames or he'd win, you know, in big ways.
Would you have been watching live that 96 Masters?
That's going right, way right.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember because we were in Tasmania playing a junior series that week, and I remember being on the course and like word filtered around the course on, well, Thursday for the Masters that he'd shot 63. And it's like, oh, here we go. He's going to win, you know. And then when Monday morning we were watching and, you know, I remember Charlie Earp being up at Royal Queensland, which is his longtime kind of mentor, and he just flicked the television off after it went in the water on 16.
Good looking shot. It's heading at the flag. Is it the right number? Wow. 2 days in a row. There's the ball submerged. That ball will not be playable. 3 bogeys in a row. And then this.
You know, and you're quick to forget, but like the Shark and was one of those bigger than golf people in Australia. Oh, he still is. And everyone would watch the Masters when the Shark was playing. It was like the country stopped when Kieran Perkins swam the 1500 kind of stuff, you know? And that's kind of how I remember the Shark. And, you know, we're 25 years later. He was such a huge influencer on in Australia.
I'm back to Scotty in a moment. I'm not exactly sure who is up on episode 101 of the show. Episode 100's taken up a fair amount of time. But as an aside, I get a lot of feedback, too much feedback for my liking, that people enjoy the questions from the Pickle and the Big Penguin more than they do my questions. So here is my favourite work from these two lunatics. Back when they were a bit younger, it must be said, but as MJ found out when he let them down, they've always been a really tough crowd.
Hey crew, Big Penguin here. On the topic of not giving in, what happened to our producer, old mate MJ, when he went to the Singapore Grand Prix, Pickle?
Well, Penguin, Daddy set him one job only.
What job, Pickle?
You remember, Pengy, to get a Howie Games episode lined up with our man, Lewis Hamilton.
MJ getting Lewis? Please, Pickle, talk about a boy on a man's mission.
No, Pengy, I admit, I thought MJ was a bit of a donkey. Not your top line talent, but magnificent MJ sent this video back of him apparently lining up Lewis one-on-one when the hammer was arriving at the circuit.
Bulldust, Pickle.
Nope, check it out. Let's see how he went.
Lewis, MJ here from Australia. Good luck on the weekend.
What, that's it? I don't think there's any more. Hang on, there must be.
Lewis, MJ here from Australia. Good luck on the weekend.
Lewis, MJ from Australia. What a bloody turkey, Pickle.
That was embarrassing, Pengy. The hammer didn't even turn around. Gave our boy donuts.
Told you, Pickle. He can't fire a shot, that kid.
That type of gear is bad for our brand, Pengy.
Not for much longer, Pickles. Sack the clown, I reckon.
Agreed.
He's a poo head.
Yeah, getting ahead of themselves, those two. Alrighty, back to Adam.
I want to frame this discussion with you about golf through three particular tournaments. One that will probably mean nothing to you too, that one will be very obvious and the other one will be obvious when we start talking about it and maybe a touch painful. But I think it frames up the third one. But what was it like turning pro for the first time? You're in Europe, you're a young man. What was it actually like as a young bloke stepping out onto the course with these legends of European golf?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, I think maybe every generation of golfer has these feelings, but I feel like I came along just at this amazing time when Tiger had been a pro about 3 or 4 years and things were really starting to gain momentum in golf. So there was a real buzz about golf globally everywhere. Maybe there was before, but I didn't know, but that's the feeling I had. And around the turn of the century in Europe, you know, Seve was still playing the tour. Woosnam, Sandy Lyles, Sam Torrences, all these guys that were kind of legends of the Ryder Cup through the 70s and 80s. Faldo was still playing the tour. Then the newer wave of European stars were there. And I got to experience all that. And in what I'd call, compared to today, a really intimate setting, the European tour was. We all traveled together. We'd stay in the cities around Europe together, often going out to dinner together. You know, it's far more individual these days. But that was those first 3 years I played in Europe was the best experience for me and best memories, I think, of my professional career.
And what does winning for the first time mean for you?
The Alfred Dunhill Championship in Johannesburg. Have I got that right, Scotty?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. What's it like when you walk off the 72nd hole for the first time as a winner?
I think it was just a big relief thing for me. I mean, if I think back to it, I was playing against now one of my good mates, Justin Rose. We were head-to-head down the stretch and I got him by one. I had a four-footer on the last that I somehow nervously wiggled in the hole. And I remember seeing a replay of it and, you know, you just have to read the lips of what I said to the caddy after I hold the putt. I think I was a wreck. So, you know, it was...
What did you say? What am I reading in the lips? Right, okay. I've read it on Zoom. Okay,
so,
good.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking, but that's what I'd always dreamed it would kind of be, and that was my honest reaction. I had a really experienced caddy on the bag too, Dave Rennick, a Scottish guy who'd caddied for Elkington when he won the USPGA Championship. He'd caddied for Alathabel when he won the Masters, and he's a hell of a caddy, and I had him early on in my career. And just to get over the line so quickly and feel that pressure, you know, was everything I'd wanted, but I wasn't prepared for just how nerve-wracking it was.
A future Masters champion, outdueled Justin Rose in 2001. Adam Scott winning at Houghton Golf Club.
Did you get to, do you go out and have a few beers to celebrate as a young bloke when you finally won?
Or yeah, absolutely.
Have you got a party story for me?
You know, you do stupid stuff when you're young and somehow, luckily, you get away with it. I mean, I showed up that week in South Africa, had never been there before in my life, flew over by myself, got to the airport. I thought there was a transport to pick me up and there wasn't. And some guy said, hey, you want a taxi? And I'm like, yeah, no worries. So I got my suitcase and my clubs and I'm wheeling them down, you know, in the underground car park thing at the airport. And they throw me in this white van and I'm like, you know, driven off. It's completely unmarked car and they actually dropped me at the hotel. And when I told this story to my buddy, I have a good buddy who's from Joburg, Michael Kirk, and we went to college in Vegas together. He was there. He's like, you are so lucky to be here playing this week after that. Never do that again. So, you know, just had no idea. But then Sunday afterwards, Michael, my buddy, and I, we went out in Sandton in Johannesburg. And tied one on, that's for sure.
Good.
Feeling very ordinary on Monday.
The tournaments I mentioned, the first one I want to talk to you about, because you mentioned Tiger and what he's done for the game. 2003 World Match Play, from what I read, you lost a semi to Tiger on the 19th hole. What's it like playing with Tiger Woods when at that point, mate, he was the most dominant athlete on the planet?
Yeah, it was up until that point, I'd really, really struggled playing with Tiger, and I'd played with him a lot in practice rounds, and that didn't help me at all. That just made me feel kind of more inferior. Because Tiger was brutal, you know, he would just challenge you until you couldn't hang with him, you know, and he'd always win. And, of course, that's, you know, it's a little bit like watching that Michael Jordan Last Dance thing.
Yep.
You know, he'll just push you until, so he'll win. And that's what it was like with Tiger. And I don't think he meant it in a nasty way at all, but it was just his way. And, you know, I struggled to keep up with him in these practice rounds and it often kind of broke me. And I was playing really well that week, I remember. And we were both working with Butch Harmon at the time, and I said to Butch, who was obviously very favourable to Tiger in the way they did things, but that was part of the deal of working with Butch at the time. You had to accept that. And I said, you know, what piece of advice would you give me? And he said, I think you should not watch him play at all today. You just forget.
Right.
Watching him hit a shot, just don't. So I mean, at the start, I had to actually, I just turned my back on the tee box and didn't watch. And so I just played my game and didn't get sucked into playing his game, trying to play his game, or being, because he was hitting shots that no one else could hit. He was hitting it 30 yards past everyone. Everything was better than anyone else could do. And if you tried to keep up, you couldn't. And then if it sat in your mind, it was a negative. So I literally didn't watch him hit a shot, but it was a great, great match. We played some really good golf and I was one down with three to go, I remember. And Tiger hit it to a foot on the 16th. So it looked like this is over, but I knocked it on and hold my putt to stay one down. We halved 17 and I birdied 18 to send it to extra holes. And unfortunately, I missed like a 5 or 6 footer or something on that one to lose. But it was good for my confidence to hang with him a bit for once. You know, he'd just really broken me for a few years at that point when we played.
When you say he's broken you and you use the word brutal, is that just a physical, what he's doing on the golf course, or it's a mental side of it as well? Like, what happens in that situation, Scotty?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, I remember a couple of times in practice rounds with him at majors, you know, he'd play the mental games. He was so complete. And I say that, but every level was higher than the highest level anyone else had. So his mental level, you know, his physical attributes were amazing, but his mental level was like no one we'd ever seen in golf before.
So what are the mental games?
So we played in my first ever major, we played a practice round at St. Andrews in 2000 and played, I think it was with Tiger, O'Meara and DeVal. Mm-hmm. And they played a game, often $1,000 no bogeys in practice rounds. So whoever doesn't make a bogey for the practice round, $1,000, which is hard in a major because they're the hardest setups. So the game's going on, and after 10 holes, I'm the only guy who hasn't made a bogey. And the 11th is a pretty long par three, and Tiger gets up first, and he hits a 4-iron right in the middle of the green. And, like, I made the mistake to look in his bag and see he's hit a 4-iron because I had 5-iron out. And so I go back to the bag and hit 4. Sail it straight over the back of the green. Dead. Bogey. And he just hit, like, this kind of soft 4, but it looked like a normal one. You know, he had the ability just to end that. And I've seen him do it in competition with guys as well. You know, 12th hole at Augusta, he's done it a lot. With guys where he hits more club and then they match him and hit it in the back bunkers and that stuff. Yeah, he's incredible. He had incredible control and confidence in what he was doing to play those kind of games.
Scotty, I can only ask you about this next tournament because the one after it is the one that everyone wants to hear you talk about.
Mm.
The 2012 British Open. You talked about the mental side of the majors. What do you think when you look back at that? Is it still a brutal question to ask you, like, 9 years later?
It's probably... It gets harder to accept now, I think, that I didn't win.
On the team from Australia, Adam Scott.
Four-shot lead for Adam Scott. But on a golf course like this, you can't afford to make any mistakes. Important for him to go off to a really steady start.
Because I've had chances since and I haven't won. And, you know, chances are disappearing. It's just the way it is. So, and I feel like that's the tournament I want to win most now.
So maybe a march to a first major title for Adam Scott, but four shots can disappear. Everyone talks about the final four holes, five holes perhaps here at Royal Lytham and St Anne's being so difficult, and Adam Scott has to negotiate four of them. But four clear, four to play, you'd take that.
And I'm trying not to put the pressure on myself. It couldn't have been a better opportunity to win the tournament. And I just did a lot of average stuff coming in. It was a small error after a small error on each hole. And if I'm critical of myself in that, which is easy to be because bogeying the last four is not good.
Okay, Scotty, big putt. That is purely nerves. That's all it is.
You know, I did not hole one putt in the last four holes. And it's very rare that anyone wins a tournament without holing a putt down the stretch of some length. You know, 5 feet, 20 feet, 100 feet, something, you know. So usually when you win a tournament, you hole a putt at the end. And I missed every one.
Pace and line. Sounds a bit obvious.
Yeah, well, everything's got to be right this time.
Everything's got to be
stroke,
spot on.
Breathing. This is it. This to tie.
There it is, Adam Scott. Ernie Els wins. Congratulations, Ernie. And Adam Scott's going to be scarred for life.
And, you know, you just have to be tougher than that. And it was the first time in my career that a major championship was on my stick.
Yep.
And I guess that's what I learned from it. You know, I just had to be tougher in some way. Maybe it wasn't, at the time I wasn't analysing it as the putts, but I just had to be a bit tougher to close it out. And I think when we had a bit of a debrief on it, my coach and Steve Williams, my caddy and myself, it was basically that from memory. It was like, and then the determination, it was just there was no let up until a result, and the result came about 7 or 8 months later. But we just pushed hard because we knew it was my time. It was all, and that really showed me I had the ability to win the major, that event.
So what do you learn about yourself as an athlete, as a person, when things go wrong for you like that in your profession?
I think it's not about the minutes and hours afterwards, you know. It's a bit of a blur. You can't believe it. You know, there's emotion, there's adrenaline, there's all kinds of things. It's a bit of a blur, but I don't know, the next time I got out on the range, I think I gave myself three days, and I got back out on the range and I was hitting balls, and I'm hitting balls good. Yeah, I'm hitting it good still. It's not, it hasn't all fallen apart.
Okay.
And I pretty quickly just realized, you know, I've lost a tournament. I've lost tournaments before. Absolutely, it hurts, but, you know, I'm now going to give myself the opportunity to win some more. And that was pretty much three days, and we're moving on. Yeah.
What you have to do, though, and I was watching it last night on YouTube, you have to go to the press conference afterwards. How difficult is that to answer questions? Like, it's not a... We need to move on because it's not a pleasant topic to talk to you about now.
That's okay.
But this is 9 years later, but this was 9 minutes later. And I looked at Ernie, and Ernie says, you know, I really feel for Adam because he'd had similar circumstances.
I really feel for my buddy, Scotty. You know, I really do. You know, I've been there before. I've blown majors before and golf tournaments before, and just hope he doesn't take it as hard as I do.
What's it like then to walk in knowing, oh, no, this could have been my first major. It slipped away from you for whatever reason, and now I have to answer questions about it.
Yeah, it's a tough position to be in, I think.
Tough position. Tough position, Scotty.
And you got to play some good shots to win these golf tournaments, and I wasn't able to do that the last few holes. Sure, I'm very disappointed, but I felt like I played well this week, and it's probably a great chance.
It was all a bit of a blur immediately afterwards. You know, the hurt hadn't set in. I think that came in it came in waves in a couple of days afterwards. You know, I wasn't feeling the hurt. You know, Ernie is a great mate of mine. He's been a real mentor to me over the years, and maybe it hurt a little bit less at initially afterwards because he'd won, and look, he's class, he's waited around, he gave me a big hug. He said, I'm going to get mine, you know, he said all the right things that you'd want someone to say, and I know he genuinely felt for me. There was a part of me that was genuinely happy for him too, You know, I feel like he's one of the most talented guys I've ever seen play. And yeah, just took him to a bit higher level, having another major. But I was a bit feelingless, I think, through that. So I could just sit there and answer, and I don't even remember what questions were asked or how you're feeling. I couldn't really give you an idea. I was just numb at that point. It was probably a bit of disbelief that it can happen, but it does. It's not the first time we've seen it happen. No. And I think, you know, the next 3 days to process it and then go back out on the range and hit some balls and move on it worked for me that, you know, I needed to do that because the PGA Championship was around the corner and I was playing great. So let's go.
We will get to the Masters. And I'm looking forward to talking about the Masters with you. But prior to that, talk to me, explain to me what pressure is like in the closing stages of a major and how you deal with pressure in your profession. Because it's not like a game of footy where, you know, it happens and bang and the ball comes to you and you snag a goal. You stand over that shot.
Mm.
How do you clear your thoughts? How do you not let the negative thoughts come in? Like, how does it work, Scotty, for you, the mental side of it?
Mm. I think most athletes, most professional sportsmen, women will tell you that everything's done in preparation for the event. It's all done there. All that the mental belief, the positivity comes from the work you put in before. And then when you're there, the trick is to switch your mind off and execute and play with whatever it is. And golf is tough because the golf swing's a very dynamic movement and you want it to be reactive, but it's not. You have so much time to think about walking up to your shot, standing over it. You're not moving. You're standing very still with your head down over the ball and you can stand there for 30 seconds if your mind's ticking. But you want to keep it fairly clear, so developing strong routines is really important. And they become natural, and that's just what it is, whether it's the first tee shot on Thursday, a shot on the 12th hole Friday, or the 18th hole or the 72nd hole of the Masters. When I watch the replay of the Masters and, like, see me playing the last couple of holes, I mean, the interaction with Steve Williams and I think, is amazing. Like, the intensity, the focus and the clarity. You know, there's no umming and ahhing between us. Mm. It's, here's a question, here's the answer, that's it, we do it. You know, it was really, really good stuff that there was no room to wander off with your mind and your thoughts anywhere. It was, we're just getting the job done. And that, you know, and obviously, in some ways, to our advantage, it was off the back of a hard loss. So there was even more intensity and focus.
So before we talk about the Masters, what's your relationship with your putter? It's often discussed in your career.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to know how you view it.
Well, I'm probably a much better putter than everyone thinks I am. But for me, the putter has been the most temperamental club in my bag, for sure, you know, on and off relationship with it. I was very streaky putter the first part of my career and I'd putt incredibly well or really horrible. And after a while, that wore on me and that's when I decided to make a radical change and start putting with a long putter. Which was a good call at the time.
Mm.
And, you know, now I think it's one of the strengths of my game, you know, and I really feel like in the last 12 months particularly, it's been the most reliable club in my bag. I had a pretty good season last season, but that was thanks to the putter and the short game, more so than the long game. And this year, kind of where it was going, the long game was starting to match up and all of a sudden I was playing really high level golf. It's on pause at the moment, but you know, I think it's taken me this long time to turn potentially a weakness into my strength, but that's a positive thing.
So when it's going, again, say coming back to your footy days, you know what it's like with any sport. Like if you're hitting the tennis ball well, your racket seems this big and you're lining up for goal and, you know, the goal seems 20 metres across. And if you've been shanking them on the tennis court or having a kick at footy, it's it's like it's narrow as narrow. Does the hole get like that in golf or not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does it?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, controlling the thoughts is so hard. I mean, every golfer can relate to, you know, because you get that, you get that instant feedback of the result of the shot and it's hard not to think about it and just go through the process. And it should be fairly simple. For some it is, but a lot of people struggle with it. And, you know, the ups and downs mentally with golf is crazy, but certainly with putting, which you think should be fairly simple, but sometimes you just can't do anything, can't get it in the hole, can't get it rolling at the hole. There have been times where, it felt like at the end of 2010 I'd tried everything and I'd lost like my natural DNA of putting. Like it felt like there wasn't even going to be good weeks.
Right.
Even though I won two tournaments that year, but it was just so frustrating.
Well, you see, like you see it when you work at a golf tournament, and you it fascinates me when you walk past the practice putting green, and there's like blokes with rulers and bits of string and all these gadgets and things hanging off their hats and mirrors, and you're like, heavens above!
We're crazy.
Like, how does this not get into someone's head? Like, it's there's some weird stuff out there.
It is. It is. It's really. It's a vicious cycle, be the professional golf and the putting, because there are all these things that can actually help you, you know, these training aids, and they can help you. And then it's hard to put them down because you want to be professional. You know, this is my job. I'm going to be very diligent and meticulous, and I'm going to get better and I'm going to perfect it. But then you also have to, like, embrace, like, the natural just raw talent you had of, like, looking at the hole and ball go in hole kind of attitude. So you have to find a formula that marries them all up so that the stroke's good. And that's where I was getting at. I feel like in the last 12 months I've really managed to do that with my putting. And, yeah, I mean, people would be shocked, but I'll back myself to putt against anyone out there. That, you know, the margins in pro golf are so fine between the best putter and the average putter. It's less than one stroke, one putt per round. So it's very, very, very fine. And then you have, you're hoping for your hot weeks, of course.
That's it for part A of the show. We are talking the Masters next in part B.
Listener.